imagine there's no heaven. Sees if you try.
Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome to today's edition of Equal Time for Free Thought, the show that focuses on rationality, critical thinking, and scientific naturalism. Our guest today is Stephen Eric Bronner, author of books including Socialism Unbound, Of Critical Theory and Its Theorists, A Rumor About the Jews, and the topic of today's show, The Bigot, Why Prejudice Persists. He's a distinguished professor of political science, comparative literature, and German studies at Rutgers University, New Brunswick. He's also the director and global relations at the Center for the Study of Genocide and Human Rights, also at Rutgers, and a senior editor of the academic journal Logos. So, thanks for coming on the show today, Stephen Bronner.
It's my pleasure.
And
glad to be here.
And as I talked with you about privately before, I definitely need to say thanks again, because listeners may not know, we actually spoke a few weeks back, only to have our interview lost to, I guess, the depths of the quantum mechanical world of this occasionally faulty technology we have called computers. So I really appreciate your time and dedication to speaking with us.
I fully understand the problem.
So you wrote this book, The Bigot, Why Prejudice Persists. And as you explain in the book, your goal was to help educate people on bigotry, not necessarily to convert bigots themselves, because getting them just to read the book would be a feat on its own. But I would like to talk today about bigotry. And I think it would be useful to talk about the different aspects of what makes a bigot, point by point. So first, I'll ask you, what is one prominent, or perhaps the most prominent, component that makes up a bigot?
If I had to pick one, I would say it's a refusal to change one's ideas. Jean-Paul Sartre once said that the anti-Semite turns himself to stone. And I think that's a terrific description of the racist in general, or the bigot in general. The bigot tends to identify certain traits with certain natural attributes, and he won't allow his belief to be shaken. In order to protect himself, he'll employ myth, intuition, and stereotypes in order to, rather than a kind of critical discourse, an openness to dialogue, and some kind and reflective rationality. So I would say that's the key. Prejudice, after all, comes from the Latin term, I can't pronounce it, prejudicum, which basically means that one is starting with fixed and forms of prejudgment in evaluating a phenomenon.
So surely we all have some form of a sense of what other people are like, and we make judgments all the time, every day. But what is it about bigotry that makes it become so solidified that, as you said, people become completely unwilling to change? What do you think it is that makes people go that far in terms of their notions about other people?
It's an important question you ask, which actually has a few different layers. In the first instance, obviously, they're statements that can be made and generalizations that can be formed that are completely legitimate. It's probably fair to say that Italians like Italian food, and that Chinese people like Chinese food. But that doesn't limit their possibilities and their potential to like other forms of food. What the bigot does and what a genuine prejudice does is inherently limit the target of his hatred or his prejudice to particular roles and to particular possibilities. So, for example, women can't learn mathematics. People of color are good at sports, meaning essentially that they can't do anything else. Hmm. That's the kind. Jews are somehow inherently cheap or deceitful, and they can't be generous and good. It's that kind of thing that I think really defines the bigot. Or defines real serious prejudice. And I think the reason why the bigot is fixed in his views and takes these kind of positions vis-a-vis previously excluded groups and the like is really comes down to this. It's possible to say that everyone is slightly or somewhat prejudiced. That's probably true too, but I don't think that helps. That helps explain very much. I think the real issue is the political issue. In other words, why are some groups more prejudiced than others? Why do reactionary movements tend to embrace prejudice more than progressive movements?
Hmm.
Now, let me be clear. I'm not saying that every conservative or reactionary is necessarily a bigot. Mussolini and his followers basically didn't employ racism as an ideological weapon until very late. But so it's not necessary, for example, for a fascist to be a racist.
Hmm.
But there is a tendency for a reactionary group to embrace prejudice more than a progressive group. And I think the reason is very simple. Even though it's true that not every conservative is a bigot, it tends to be true that most bigots are conservatives, if I can put it that way. You and I can disagree with people of differing political persuasions on this or that policy pertaining to women or people of color or immigrants or what have you. There's no question about that. But when a situation comes about in the United States where an entire agenda, like that of the Tea Party and at this point the Republican Party, is fundamentally directed against women, people of color, gays, and the like, then obviously there's something different going on than just the reasonableness of disagreement. Indeed. I think that it's telling that the targets of prejudice are precisely those groups who are outside a world shaped by white men. Now, if we think of reactionary groups and conservative groups, it is interesting that the only group that President Obama lost was white men.
Right.
He was every other group, women, people of color, immigrants, and the like, supported him overwhelmingly, or at least in the majority. The question is why. And what I believe is that the white male tends to want to maintain his privilege. Prejudice is always connected, I think, to privilege. And if you think of it this way, you can take seriously the image that existed about what America was supposed to be. I quote a racist, a white supremacist band, or the lyrics from the white supremacist band in The Bigot. And that goes, whatever happened to America, which once was white and free?
Mm-hmm.
That says it.
Yeah.
Imagine, think of the TV shows from the 50s and the 60s. Father Knows Best, Leave It to Beaver, later on, Happy Days. All of these shows have something in common. Women are in the kitchen, gays are in the closet, and people of color, when they enter the scene, usually have menial jobs.
Hmm.
Not only that, more important, they like it. And so a situation comes about in which the privileges of white males are confirmed. And the explanation for why these groups today rebel against those ascribed roles is that they've been riled up from the outside. So, for example, if you think of the first American blockbuster film, Birth of a Nation, which was about the Ku Klux Klan, a positive rendition of the Ku Klux Klan.
Right, right.
What you find in the film is first of all that the real enemy is not blacks. The real enemy is white liberals who rile up Southern blacks to contest their subaltern roles.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting because that viewpoint doesn't call into question the latent assumptions about the inferiority of blacks. The second thing that's interesting in this film is, I think, also something crucial for The Bigot, and that is projection. So in the film, a central theme is that black men are obsessed with raping or molesting white women. In fact, of course, during that period, it wasn't black men who were raping white women. It was white men who were raping
right.
black women.
Right.
And that projection, that idea of projection, in which you're ascribing to the, in which the bigot ascribes to, his own motives to the target of his hatred, thereby justifying his activities. That, I think, is a crucial aspect of all forms of bigotry.
Well, I think one of the most difficult things about talking about bigotry is that I feel almost as if there's two different types of bigotry. There's the bigotry that is essentially unashamed. They have no problem using slurs, and they have no problem just instantly and strongly rejecting any move forward when it comes to any other group getting any sense of personhood or receiving further rights than the minimal ones that they already have. There's that type. But then it seems that there's also a passive bigot, I guess I'll call it, which is this type that will go along with being anti-gay or supporting the idea of women are supposed to stay in the kitchen and not go off to work, those type of things. But it doesn't seem like it's something malicious. It seems they don't even understand that they are doing it. So what do you think makes the difference between the, I guess what I'll call powerful bigot versus the passive bigot?
Well, let me see if I can just tweak that distinction a little bit. One of the cardinal aspects of the bigot, as I understand it, is a certain opportunism and a certain adaptability. And what that means is that in a situation where obviously previously excluded groups have now gained a foothold, have organized and pushed their interests and so on, and changed the discourse, a weird situation results. Namely, that the old language and the old style recedes or fades. You don't see people in white hoods anymore. You don't see the goose step. You don't hear the explicitly racist language, at least not that much. I think that that far more important than that, if I can put it this way, is the bigot who is hiding. That is to say, who will use liberal language or use non-racist language to justify policies that disadvantage the targets of his hatred. So, for example, why do we oppose, food stamps and welfare state policies? It's not because we're opposed to people of color, blacks and Latinos. No, we do it in order to highlight the need for personal responsibility. Why do we support restraints or on voting ID and the like? We want to oppose fraud. Why do we, why do we oppose multicultural education and affirmative action? Because we want to keep up standards. In each case, a policy that directly targets and disadvantages previously excluded groups and traditional targets of prejudice is pursued without talking about, without explicitly talking about prejudice and bigotry. And I think in the book I talk about how the bigot adapts today in by assuming certain social roles. The true believer, who would be, for example, the religious dogmatist or absolutist, who, if you like, shrouds his prejudice in a commitment to the important or the solidifying aspects of religion. The more aristocratic elitist who is concerned with the decline of standards, the chauvinist who's just speaking for the original vision of America. These are ways in which, or these are roles in which, the bigot can appear and justify himself in a new context. This doesn't mean that every person of faith or every person who is an elitist or every person who is a patriot or a chauvinist is going to be a bigot. But what it does mean is that these roles are particularly amenable to the political pursuit of bigotry, if that makes sense. And I want to add one other thing. I've often been criticized for saying, well, what you're really doing is simply identifying the bigot with conservatism or traditionalism and the like. I suggested previously that there is indeed an elective affinity between ideologies of prejudice and reactionary movements. But it doesn't mean that. That doesn't mean that it's impossible for blacks or Latinos or Jews or women to harbor bigotry themselves. So, for example, Jews can act as can literally take on the the attributes of anti-Semites in dealing with Palestinians,
right,
or Arabs. Blacks can act as racists by their treatment or by their views directed against Jews or Latinos or gays, and so on. That's possible. The issue for progressive movements is to pursue the agenda of their particular group for inclusion into the public sphere without indulging in the bigotry that was leveled against them.
Right.
And there's something else here. The reason for this, that, for example, Jews can become anti-Semites or blacks can become racist, is because it's never about the victim. It's about the image that's created of the victim by the bigot. So when you're talking about bigotry and how people should adapt and the like, how victims should adapt to the existing order and the like, this isn't the issue. The issue is the image that the bigot has in his head of the target of his prejudice. Blacks are not the way the bigot believes them to be. Jews are not the conspiratorial, unified agent of seeking world domination that the anti-Semite believes them to be, and so on. So I just wanted to make that clear.
Well, one thing that occurred to me a little while back and something you said when we were talking a little bit about the conservatives, and we were referring in particular to this brand that we have in the United States of right-wing conservatism, I was thinking to myself, when we're having this discussion about bigotry and about how they will make an argument that they don't claim that it is based on bigotry. For example, the reason for gay marriage to oppose gay marriage isn't because we hate gay people. It's because we want to preserve tradition,
right?
You know, and the same thing with something like affirmative action and right, all of that. So I guess what I was thinking was from their perspective, I can imagine them saying, "Well, how do you know that I am doing this out of bigotry as opposed to actually doing it because I truly believe that we need to defend the tradition of marriage and we need to promote this idea that everyone has to take on a certain amount of responsibility in their lives." You know, how do we, from our liberal point of view, how can we say that it is from bigotry that these arguments are made as opposed to perhaps the idea that maybe these people actually genuinely do believe that they are not coming from a state of bigotry, but are indeed coming from this idea of protection of tradition and trying to promote the idea that people have to have a certain amount of responsibility for themselves?
I think you might be surprised by my answer. I'm not sure that the motivation matters. I think what matters, in other words, what ultimately matters is the effect of the policy they're pursuing on the victim, not how the possible bigot feels about the matter. It's one of the shocking things about American politics, and a politics, of course, in which apathy runs rampant. It's a shocking thing. People will go absolutely crazy about, I don't know, a politically incorrect word or phrase that's employed. And I'm not obviously not condoning that, nor am I condoning the sensational acts, the killing of black teenagers by white-dominated police and the like. Right. Clearly, I'm not condoning that, and I believe these things should be obviously dealt with. But people go nuts over these kind of issues. but in actual policies that affect millions of people, for example, privatizing prisons.
Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah, that's a big one. Where upwards, sometimes up to 80-90% of the people incarcerated are people of color and Latinos. Nobody says boo about that. Or if they do raise criticisms, then that becomes a legitimate area of discourse. You know what I mean? It's almost as if the practice of bigotry is open to, shall we say, tolerant debate without moral sanction, while the sensational act or the sensational words, slogans, that is immediately morally condemned. And it's what's so odd, of course, is Americans pride themselves on being pragmatic and practical. And I guess that's true. That may even be true, but not when it comes to the politics of bigotry. And I think we have to shift our views on this matter a little bit.
I think I understand what you're saying, but just to rephrase to make sure that I'm getting it, are you suggesting that the kind of instant reactionary events that occur, like you're saying with killing
if
people,
Trayvon Martin or something?
Yeah, exactly. Like that. There's that, but I think what you're saying is that the slightly more subtle but long-term and legal implementation that affects dramatically people of color as well as any other group of people that struggles to maintain their equal position among the rest of their countrymen, that is in a sense just as dangerous, but that we often don't treat it as if it's just as dangerous. Is that kind of what your point?
That's, okay. You put it very well. And to put it in a sort of more soundbite, manner. Words wound, but policies wound even more. And I think this is something we have to begin to take seriously. Again, this or that policy should be open to debate. There's no question about it. But when an entire agenda becomes defined by targeting the subaltern, the excluded, then it's another matter entirely.
This is Matthew DeClaire. You're listening to Equal Time for Free Thought on WBAI 99.5 FM. My guest today is Professor Stephen Bronner. We're talking about his book, The Bigot, Why Prejudice Persists. And we just got through talking about the motivations of bigotry and why it's actually not all that important about the motivation. It's more important about what happens in our politics. And speaking of that, I think that it's unfortunate that our last conversation a few weeks ago ended up essentially being deleted, so we had to redo this interview. But in a way, I guess it's kind of a positive thing because now we get to talk after the 2014 midterm elections. Not that those were necessarily a great thing in themselves, but it's good that we get to talk about this in light of those results. So before I ask you anything, I'd like just to briefly introduce just two of the individuals who are now in control of Congress, because it wouldn't really surprise me if there were many listeners out there who were unaware of how outrageously bigoted some of the people who were elected really are. One of them is House Republican Glenn Grothman of Wisconsin. I'm not sure if you had heard about him, but he has proposed banning public school teachers from mentioning homosexuality because he believes that some teachers have an agenda to turn kids gay. He also said that the government is doing, quote, what they can to promote the women ahead of the men in hiring practices. And he concluded the series of statements on hiring females more frequently with saying, quote, our country is not going to survive if we continue this war on men. That's
Ann Coulter said very commentator, Ann Coulter, conservative commentator, said very much the same thing. And I think this is a perfect example of what I said, what I just said before. Namely, does it really matter what the congressman feels he's doing? Or is what really counts the type of political action he's engaged in?
Right. Well,
it harms.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in a way, the only thing that's making me think that the motivation could potentially be important is that I assume – I could be wrong, but I assume that the people who decided to vote for folks like Glenn Grothman of Wisconsin are interested in his motivations at the very least. And unfortunately, I think that if his motivation is indeed founded, and he makes it clear that it's founded in a form of outward bigotry, that there are many segments of the population that would be more willing to vote for somebody like that, as opposed to somebody who promotes the same kinds of policies, but is not quite as outspoken about their position.
Well, let me see if I can put it a little more generally, because I don't know the specifics of the congressman's campaign and the like. But what seemed to occur nationally and what led to the defeat of the Democratic Party, or the electoral defeat of the Democratic Party, was the fact that young white kids turned more conservative. It wasn't that blacks didn't come out, it wasn't that women didn't come out, etc. It was this particular group that became was mobilized, and I think that's a fault of the progressive community. I do. I think one of President Obama's weaknesses, I think he has two in particular. One is that is unable to, well, he seems unable to really make clear the positive policies in that he's forwarded. There always seems something defensive about the way he talks about his own policies, or the way he just slips them through or passes them through Congress, and then sort of lets it go. Even with, that's even true with regard to healthcare, and I think that's very unfortunate. In other words, there's just an inability to sell his policies. The second thing, and perhaps connected with this, is his choice of advisors. Often, President Obama was identified or likened to Franklin Delano Roosevelt. But there's no Francis Perkins, the Secretary of Labor, and no Harry Hopkins in his cabinet. It's technocratic, and it's, how should we say, establishmentarian in the worst sense. And so I think those are the two technical aspects, the two technical aspects, that white kids were mobilized to vote in a conservative direction is a very worrying matter. Now, at the same time, I think we have to be clear that the vote, so to speak, is different from the way in which people get, or the number of people who get elected. Let me go back. If you think of the last two presidential elections, what you find is that President Obama didn't have a mandate in terms of the populace. Basically, he won these two elections roughly 52 or 53% as against 47, 48%. And now consider something. Especially in that first election of Obama, one talks about the hope and so on and so forth that influenced his victory. And that's true. I mean, there was that, and maybe one can certainly make an argument that he didn't live, that his policies didn't live up to the ideals he presented. That's open to discussion. But what's not is the following. Here we have President Obama and Vice President Biden. They run a perfect campaign. There are no mistakes. The Republicans run the two worst possible
horrendous
candidates.
Yeah.
Yeah, which one can imagine? John McCain and Sarah Palin. Two, the country is involved in two failed wars and an economic collapse of epic proportions, and still 47% of the population votes for the Republicans. That should tell you something. It certainly tells me something. And it's certainly worth thinking about. In short, when you talk about the elections and the way single-member districts and the like are organized, we're talking about a few percent of the, maybe tops, 10% of the population being swing votes. When we talk about bigotry, we're talking about something that is not, that has its source in the populace as a whole.
Hmm.
And the traditions associated with that populace. Let's consider the Tea Party. We have always liked to think of this as a new phenomenon, for better or worse. What I would suggest is that that's a mistake. That from the beginnings of the country, or the virtual beginnings of the country, we've had a reactionary movement of this type that's been associated with the ideology of prejudice. If we think in the first half of the 19th century, there was the Know Nothing Party. Then there was the Ku Klux Klan, which was a mass-based movement. Then there was the America Firsters, who were sort of, shall we say, sympathetic to the fascist cause,
right,
like Charles Lindbergh. Then there was McCarthyism. Then there was the moral majority and the silent majority and the various other majorities. This, in short, the Tea Party has, so to speak, been a constant of American policy. And not only that, these movements basically come from the same areas, and they have the same class character.
Hmm.
It's interesting. And that class character is primarily derived from the least economically developed segments of the country, and from closed communities, working class, ethnic working class pockets of the cities, plus, shall we say, contractors, owners of small businesses, and the like, what used to be called the petty bourgeoisie, as well as farmers and agricultural workers. And that serves as the base for these movements, for virtually all of these movements. What's interesting about these is that, in a certain way, these are precisely the classes and the people who fear a multicultural, pluralist society, if I can put it that way. It's the people who push the small town myths of America, who have the image of a white America as their identity, and who see in the triumph or in the successes of these previously excluded groups, immigrants, people of color, women, gays, and the like, the erosion of their worldview. And that's a real phenomenon. It's not just about economic policies. It's about these kind of sociological and political and psychological threats that manifest themselves, particularly with these groups. Now, there's something else that I think is worth considering, which we haven't discussed. You know, there have been many really fine studies of sexism and anti-Semitism and racism and the like. But I like to think that The Bigot is unique, or my book, The Bigot, is unique because it seeks to talk about the existential, psychological, sociological, and political dynamics of prejudice in general. In other words, in terms of the dynamics that underpin each of these forms of prejudice, if that makes sense. That's The Bigot. And I think that's justified because bigotry always comes in clusters, what I call clusters. It's almost impossible, it's very, very rare that any group or person will be prejudiced against only one group. There are always multiple groups. Nazis were not just prejudiced against Jews. Same with the Ku Klux Klan, it was not only prejudiced against blacks. And that's true, I think, across the board. And so I think we have to deal with the phenomenon of the bigot rather than simply this or that form of bigotry.
Right. Well, and I guess that in your book, perhaps it was, I don't know if easier is the right word, probably not, but easier or at least closer to home to talk about bigotry in the context of this country. But I was wondering throughout the book what you think about the types of bigotry that we have here in the United States versus bigotry as it exists in places like the Middle East, because you talk a good deal about the white male of this society, and I was wondering what your thoughts were about bigotry as it exists elsewhere in places like the Middle East. The reason I jumped there is because I understand that that you visited there and met with some important individuals out there in Syria and Iran. So can you tell me just a little bit about if there are any ways that you perceive explaining or talking about bigotry in the context of a place like the Middle East, as opposed to how it exists here in the United States?
Let me first mention some of the similarities, and then perhaps I can talk about the differences. I'm not denying that there are specific historical issues or sociological traditions that affect bigotry. All
of course,
is that they're fundamental dynamics. Okay, let me give an example. I still work as the executive chair of U.S. Academics for Peace. I was in Iraq before the war. I've been to Syria. I met President Assad. I've been to the West Bank. And other places as well. So one of the things that's in the Middle East is very, very similar, not exactly the same, but very, very similar, is the reliance on conspiracy thinking.
Hmm.
Rather than, I discussed this in the book, that the bigot tends to be drawn towards what I call conspiracy fetishism.
Fetishism, yeah.
And there's a very simple reason. If the bigot is unwilling to get into a dialogue and unwilling to intellectually put his position on the line, conspiracy is always the best way to proceed because it's always hidden by definition. Okay, so when I got to Iraq, and this is true, I think, generally, but I was struck by it in Iraq, that every second conversation I had was about the infamous protocols of the Elders of Zion, which I discussed in my book, A Rumor About the Jews. Short and sweet, the protocols of the Elders of Zion is the fabricated document that essentially proves or seeks to prove that Jews are engaged in a world conspiracy to overturn first a Christian civilization. In the Middle East, of course, it's to overturn Islamic civilization.
Wow, yeah.
So that's a good change. Hmm. Let me give an example, though, of how the packaging of bigotry can be different. In the United States, when Protocols of Zion were first publicized by Henry Ford in one of his papers, there was a distinctly American ring to some of this. And in different versions, American versions of the Protocols of Zion, I mean, we're not talking about academic consistency here. What comes up is that the Jews from time immemorial have been engaged in a war to the death with Aryan or white Christian civilization. And this included ruining the World Series of 1919.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, that, of course, is not an issue that is going to move the Arab world.
Yeah, I figure in that context, no.
Yeah, but what might move the Arab world is, for example, particularly, is ideas of blood rituals engaged in by the Jews. The idea that that Jews are somehow manipulating Washington behind the scenes. Yeah, now that also came up in Europe, but it's of particular importance to much of the Arab world. Another example is it was taken seriously. I'm not saying that every Arab believes this or every Muslim believes this. Far from it. But there is a significant segment of society that does believe what I'm going to say. 9/11 was caused by the Jews. How do we know that? We know the claim is no Jews were killed in 9/11, which of course is ridiculous. But facts don't matter here. Mm-hmm. That's the important thing, because you're not engaging in a critical dialogue of your position. You're basically asserting what you your preconceptions. That's what prejudice is, after all. In Syria, the Protocols of Zion were pushed by one of its former ministers of defense. He authored it, or edited it. And it's seen as a totally, let me put it this way, it's seen as one important way of understanding political and social events. It's quite shocking, quite shocking. Another difference, of course, would be the role played by Zionism, and that, of course, plays a particular role in how anti-Semitism is framed in the Middle East, as against the way it was framed in Europe in the 20s and 30s. And even here, by anti-Semites. Hmm. It's also very easy. It's interesting as we talk about this. It's very easy for the bigot to simply shift his negative attributes from one group to the other. Thus, it used to be the Irish who were dirty and shiftless.
Right.
Then it became the became Latinos or blacks, etc. It's very easy to do that because you and it leads us to consider something. In each case, bigotry is about the bigot, not the target of bigotry.
One thing I wonder in this conversation is it kind of leads me to a frightening conclusion that a large segment of the world's population is inherently bigoted either by brain hardwiring or by something that has been taught. So I guess the question for us, the important question for us, is what do we do about this kind of bigotry, considering the fact that it is so common among all of the world's people?
Well, let me put it this way. If we simply focus on the fact that, I don't know, the vast majority of the world is bigoted, that somehow prejudice has been hardwired, then we can't change anything. And it's sort of a useless endeavor. I don't believe that's true. And I think enormous advances have been made in fighting bigotry. But I think the issue is, while abolishing bigotry across the board entirely is a very laudable goal and sort of serves as a regulative ideal, I think what we should be concentrating on is marginalizing the bigot, whether in social or political or cultural terms. That should be our focus. And if we think of it in those terms, there are various steps that can be taken and various political agendas that can be generated.
So with this book, The Bigot, Why Prejudice Persists, before you go, I'd like you just to tell us a little bit about what your inspiration for the book was. Was it this this kind of attempt, like you're talking about now, to marginalize bigotry?
The two events that particularly inspired me. One was, if I can put it nationally, was the way President Obama was treated, even in the first term. I think most of your audience knows that the Tea Party and the reaction to Obama and the desire to sabotage his agenda occurred virtually the day after his election, with Mitch McConnell at the forefront. And I've been sort of shocked by the disrespect, the kind of vitriol that's been heaped on President Obama. Let me give an example. I've seen stuff on the internet and which identifies, which sets up the bodies of chimpanzees and then superimposes the faces of the first family.
Right.
I've seen the White House lawn, depicted as filled with watermelons. We've seen that during the State of the Union, first State of the Union, somebody, one of the congressmen, yelling, "You lie." This had never been done from the floor before to a president. And so I was sort of shocked by this and shocked by the rise of the Tea Party. So that was sort of a national event that inspired the book. But there was also something that happened at Rutgers, Rutgers University, where I teach. And that is, there's been tension between different groups that's manifest sort of in subterranean ways. But something happened that was sort of striking. And that was the case of a young music student named Tyler Clementi. And Tyler Clementi was gay and had apparently a reserved young man, and he was just coming out, and he had a rendezvous with another gay person in his dorm room, whereupon that encounter was videotaped by a roommate who was himself a person of color. It was videotaped, and it went viral over the net. This led to the embarrassment of Tyler Clementi and led to his suicide by jumping off the George Washington Bridge. And that that rocked me also. And it showed that if so, that the victim himself, in this case, didn't feel there was, how should I say, the condemnation of homophobia that there should be.
Hmm.
Yeah. So it was, it was probably these two things that really had an impact, an immediate impact on me writing the book. Although there were other tendencies, other influences as well.
Right. Well, considering the amount of time and effort and energy that you put into writing books like this one, I'm grateful that you managed to maintain pretty good spirits overall. And I think part of that is just doing exactly this work of trying to expose bigotry and the ways in which it can be so harmful and damaging to not only the victims themselves, but to society as a whole. And I thank you for all of the work that you've done and for coming on our show today and talking with us about all of these really, really important issues that hopefully we will get to talk about more in the future.
Thanks for the kind words. I appreciate it. And thanks for having me on the show. It was great.
Absolutely. Thanks very much. And that's it for today's Equal Time for Free Thought. If you missed any part of this program or want to share it with friends, family, visit our website at equaltimeforfreethought.org. And remember, tune in, pay it forward, and question everything.
You know, Governor Wallace doesn't mean no harm. Can't you see he's got a lot of charm? He's protecting us whites, both rich and poor, standing in the schoolhouse door. Cracking jokes, talking to Huntley Brinkley, serving jury duty, getting re-elected. So I asked them why they spent their time with segregation on their mind. They said, if you don't like to live this way, get out of here, go back to the USA. Live with all them Russians, New York folk singers. Some say they've passed their darkest hour, those moderates are back in power. Oh, they listen close with open ears. They'll help us out in a couple of hundred years. But don't push them, whatever you do, or else you get those extremists back in. You see, Alabama is a sovereign state with sovereign dogs and sovereign hate. They stand for the Bible, for the Constitution. They stand against communist revolution. They say it's pinkos like you that freed the slaves. And they're right.